You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, we'll talk about the relationship between where you live in Wisconsin and your health. First, it's estimated that more than 40 million people were subjected to forced labor or forced marriage in 2016, according to the International Labor Organization. Of those, 4.8 million people are victims of forced sexual exploitation, and trafficking creates $150 billion in illegal profits by forcing people into forced labor or prostitution. A new bipartisan bill in the House of Representatives aims to combat human trafficking by holding countries accountable in investigating and prosecuting these crimes in order to receive foreign aid. Representative Brian Steil is a Republican representing Wisconsin's 1st Congressional District, which includes Janesville. He introduced the Exposing the Financing of Human Trafficking Act. Representative Steil, welcome back to Central Time.
Thanks for having me on.
Well, what exactly is in this bill targeting human trafficking and the financing of it?
Well, we're going to go after and exposing the financing of human trafficking. And so what we need to do is hold countries accountable that aren't doing enough as it relates to stopping the financing of human trafficking. And so currently there's a trafficking in persons report that's issued by the State Department as we look at foreign governments to make sure they're combating human trafficking. And what we need to add to that is exposing the illicit financing of human trafficking, because if we go after the money in human trafficking, we can really start to address this problem.
And what kind of leverage can the United States have over these other countries?
We have a great opportunity. When you look at the number of countries that are seeking U.S. foreign aid, and you correlate that back to countries that are some of the worst as it relates to human trafficking, we have the opportunity through leveraging our foreign aid to hold these countries accountable and to make a real difference and to make sure they're standing with us in the fight against human trafficking.
Now, this is one piece of the puzzle. How big a problem do you see human trafficking being in your part of Wisconsin?
Well, there's estimates that globally it's $150 billion in illegal profits are made from forced labor each year. We see this across the state, in particular in southeast Wisconsin, along the I-94 corridor from the Milwaukee Airport to the state line, as well as the I-90 corridor running Madison down towards Rockford. You're seeing individuals being trafficked along those lines, and where we can play a role, we need to step up and do that. I serve on the Financial Services Committee, and that puts me in a position where I can go after an attack, in particular, the illicit financing piece of this puzzle, and that's what this bill does.
Do we know how much of an element that international connection plays here in the Midwest?
Well, we saw a case recently in Racine County where there was a federal indictment of farm laborers who were being trafficked and exploited by what appears to be an international criminal gang. It is here in our community. We probably don't know the full size and scope, but every day you see stories of individuals who are victims of this, and we need to step up and play the role where we can. But where you see it is $150 billion globally, it is in our community.
You have some bipartisan co-sponsorship on this. Can you talk about that?
Absolutely. You know, we see so much partisanship in Washington, D.C. right now. I said we need to look at areas where we can come together and work and try to solve problems that are out there. And so, you know, in Wisconsin alone, I have Jim Sensenbrenner and Mark Pocan and Gwen Moore. We've all come together to say, let's address this. And so I spend my time on the House floor talking to my colleagues and saying, let's work together in areas where we can and really try to get something done. And so this is really a bipartisan effort. And every day we're gaining momentum to be able to ultimately get this across the line.
Now, you announced this, I believe I read, with a group of local law enforcement officials, other local government officials. What kind of things are you hearing from them when it comes to trafficking?
Well, when I took office in early January, I spent time moving around and talking with local sheriffs in all six counties in southeast Wisconsin, as well as our police departments in Janesville and Racine and Kenosha and across southeast Wisconsin. And time and again, I heard the struggles that our local law enforcement officers are having as it relates to human trafficking. And so it's a multifaceted problem that's going to require a sophisticated approach. Sometimes that's a high school counselor. Sometimes that's your local law enforcement. Sometimes where it's crossing state lines, that's your FBI. And then this piece of the puzzle is going after that international financing.
What is the timeline for this, given a lot going on in Congress right now?
Well, there's a lot of partisanship in Congress right now. And so my effort is to move this across as quickly as we can. I'm not sure what that timeline is, but I'm going to roll up my sleeves and I'm working hard to try to get this across the line.
Talking to Representative Brian Stile from Wisconsin, looking at a bipartisan bill he's forwarding aimed at cracking down on international financing of human trafficking. Representative Stile, do you see other efforts in the works in addition to this one when it comes to trafficking?
Yeah, it's going to require a real multifaceted approach. I mean, we need to make sure that our local law enforcement has the tools that they need to be able to go after this. We need to make sure that there's awareness across our society so that high school counselors can intervene if it's a young woman right here in our home communities who's being susceptible to this. We need to go after it from an international perspective. And so there's a multitude of efforts that need to come together to attack this problem. But if we all do this, we can make a real impact on reducing this problem.
I want to get your take, switching gears, on some news from earlier today. Special Counsel Robert Mueller, I guess now former Special Counsel Robert Mueller, spoke today publicly for the first time since releasing his report. His main message seemed to be, read the report. I don't really have anything to add to that. What did you make of what he had to say today?
Yeah, I saw the highlights of what he said earlier today. You know, I think the point is clear. Read the report. Everybody can reach their conclusion. It's publicly available. I voted in favor of making sure that report was publicly available. And then ultimately, we need to get on with the work of the American people. I hear time and again how frustrated everyone is with the partisanship in Washington. I think we need to now move on to the phase where we're working on behalf of the American people and actually getting stuff done in Washington rather than this constant partisan bickering.
I want to share two quotes from what he had to say today on the issue of obstruction of justice and the president. Quoting here, if we had had confidence that the president clearly did not commit a crime, we would have said so. And he said the Constitution, quoting, requires a process other than the criminal justice system to formally accuse the president of wrongdoing. Some people have read this as a hint that says we've laid out this obstruction of justice case. It is time now for your body, the House of Representatives, Representative Stile, to pick it up from there. Do you think that's a valid way to read what he said?
Well, let his words speak for himself. I think it's pretty clear that everybody should read the report. It's publicly available. I think that's important. I voted to make sure that it was publicly available. I read the report. I think it's time to get on with the work of the American people.
We'll leave it there for now. Representative Stile, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks so much for having me.
Brian Stile is a Republican representing Wisconsin's 1st Congressional District, which includes Janesville. He joined us to talk about a bill he's introducing to fight human trafficking by requiring countries receiving U.S. foreign aid to take a more active role in combating the practice. Coming up, a new report breaks down health trends in Wisconsin county by county. We'll look at the results and some of the stark differences from one community to another. That's coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, Special Counsel Robert Mueller made his first public statements today since beginning his investigation into Russian campaign interference in the 2016 election. We'll talk about that and more during a look at the week in Washington. First, when it comes to your health, where you live can be an important factor. Maybe you live close to an industrial area and deal with a lot of air pollution, or maybe people where you live are dealing with stress and depression from a lack of jobs. A partnership between UW-Madison's Population Health Institute and the Roger Wood Johnson Foundation is out with its annual look at these factors and health outcomes around the country and in Wisconsin. Karen Odegaard is with us to talk about it. She's a learning action coach at County Health Rankings and Roadmaps, the organization that puts out the report. Karen, thanks for joining us.
Thank you so much.
Well, one of the big takeaways looking at the report and some of the maps based on it, we have some really big disparities from county to county when it comes to health in Wisconsin.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, the county health rankings have always shown that where we live makes a difference in how well and how long we live. And we do see that here in Wisconsin with seeing differences in health outcomes and the various factors that drive those outcomes across counties in the state.
And looking at those factors, a lot of people might think health and just to think of what we think about when we go to the doctor's office. You dig into a lot more factors than what we might think of as an individual's health. Can you talk about the range of things you consider?
Yeah, absolutely. Thank you for that question. It's really important ground setting, I think, to understand that the rankings really look at a variety of factors that influence health. So we include things that, like you say, that you might typically think about when you think of health, like access to healthy foods or quality health care, whether or not you use tobacco. But we also look at the important social and economic factors that shape health, things like education, income, and safe neighborhoods.
And how much of a difference do things like income disparities or safe neighborhoods play in our overall long-term health?
Well, we like to think about the ways that different health factor areas impact health. And so we look at things like health behaviors and clinical care. And then again, those social and economic factors where, you know, things like income and community safety fall into social and economic factors, as well as the physical environment. And so we think about the proportional impact, right? How much impact do these things have on how long and how well we live? And we believe that, and we are looking at the evidence that tells us that those social and economic factors and the physical environment contribute up to 50% of a community's health. They tell us a lot about how healthy, how long, and how well people will live in a community.
So let's look at which parts of the states look pretty good when it comes to health factors and outcomes, and which don't look so good. Starting on the upside, what counties see really positive results when you look at these health measures?
Well, we see that this year Ozaukee County is ranked as our healthiest county, and you can look at the maps for the rankings at countyhealthrankings.org, and you can really see that we've got healthy counties spread throughout the state. And so there is a range of where counties are located. You see them both in some of the suburban areas of the state, but also in rural parts of the state.
So what makes a difference, say, for a rural healthy county and a rural county that doesn't do as well on these ratings? What kind of big differences do you see?
Well, when we look at where our community is today, we're really looking at the length of life and the quality of life. So when we look at communities, counties across the country or across the state, and we look at the length of life there, we see that the communities that have long lengths of life, that have low premature death rates, those are the communities that are really doing well across the state, both in rural and more suburban or urban environments.
I want to take a look at a couple counties that showed up as maybe red flags on the maps. Menominee County, for one. What kind of things did you see there when it came to health factors?
Well, when we look at Menominee County, we see that idea of premature death is really a challenge there in Menominee County. And so that's why we see Menominee County ranked at 72nd out of 72 counties. And we also see challenges in the social and economic factors and health behaviors. Those are both ranked at 72nd out of 72 counties as well. We do see a lot of strengths in the physical environment in Menominee County. And we know that Menominee County is really one of these great examples, right, of a county where their health outcomes and their health factors don't look great in the rankings. But that doesn't mean that there isn't really amazing work happening in the community. And so we do see in Menominee County, there is a lot of work going on to transform the community from what we see in the rankings data to a healthier community where people can thrive. So we see the community, which, as you likely know, shares the same borders as the Menominee Indian Reservation. And we see a lot of work here going on around trauma-informed care, both in the clinic setting, but also more broadly in the community, in schools. We see a lot of work around high school graduation, and then a lot of work around obesity, just to name a few of the things that are going on there. In fact, Menominee Nation, you may recall, was recognized in 2015 as an RWJF, or Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, Culture of Health Prize winner for the work that they're doing there.
We're talking to Karen Odegaard, talking about the newest round of county-by-county health rankings around the state of Wisconsin, looking at factors that affect health, and then looking at health outcomes as well. Let's turn to Milwaukee County, the state's biggest county by population. What kind of things did you find there?
So if we look at Milwaukee County, we see that it is actually seeing some improvements in its premature death rate. So that's good news for Milwaukee. That may mean that we're seeing some changes and transformation in the community. We see that Milwaukee County ranks 71st out of 72 counties for health outcomes. Again, how long and how well people are living. And then we also see that they're ranked 71st for health factors. And again, we think of health factors as all of those things that are going to drive how long and how well people are living in the future. So if we look across how the county is doing, we see that there are some challenges in social and economic factors, in the health behaviors, and in the physical environment. And they're doing a little better around clinical care.
So taking this report into places like Milwaukee County or Menominee County that have challenges, that have room for improvement, how do you see people taking the information from this report and then running with it in the future to really target some of the specific needs of a particular community?
Yeah, the rankings, since their inception, have always been intended to be a call to action. So what we see and what we can see in Menominee and what we see in Milwaukee and what we see in every county, really, is that there is a need for action. And where communities go with this is to take a look at the data that they see here, thinking about health in the broad sense. What is happening across the community in all of these different health factor areas? And then work together to find the solutions that are going to make the most impact in the community. These rankings and the data that we see here are a really wonderful starting point for conversation, but they don't tell the whole story. As we talked about already with Menominee County, it doesn't tell the whole story of what's happening in the community, and doesn't always highlight all of the strengths that exist in a community. And so communities like Menominee and Milwaukee can look at this data and then look at what else they need to know. What else do they know about what's happening there? Where are the challenges that they see? Where are the strengths and the assets that they can draw from? And then work together to find the solutions that are going to move the community even more forward toward a healthier population.
Now, you've mentioned communities taking action. And when I think of a county health report, I think of, you know, the county health commissioner and the health department and things like that. But a lot more people are at the table. What kind of stakeholders do you see being needed at the table to make sure that these things get addressed and that we see positive movement maybe in the next county by county health report?
Well, as you look at the county health rankings, you can see the natural stakeholders. Right? You can see that when you're talking about income and employment, we're talking about businesses, that they have a role to play in improving health in a community. When we're talking about access to healthcare and quality of care, we're talking about healthcare providers and insurers having a role to play, right? Family and social support, community safety, residents within the community have a role to play. So there are so many stakeholders who have a role to play. It is not just public health, and it is not just healthcare that are going to transform communities to allow people to thrive no matter where they live. And so it's really thinking about who has a role to play, who has an invested interest in the different factors that we see laid out in the county health rankings data. And that helps tell the story of who should be at the table. And always remembering that community residents, this is their community, and they need to be included in talking about what are the challenges that they're facing, and what do they believe are the best solutions for the community.
You mentioned that these rankings are meant as a call to action. They've been coming out for some years now. Do you see communities answering that call? Do you see more people taking this more big picture, holistic approach to solving health concerns in their communities?
Definitely. We see communities across the nation using this data to bring people to the table to start having conversations about what they can do. And we see it here in Wisconsin. We can look at Menominee as a great example. Again, they have used the rankings as they see it as a challenge, and it has helped bring people to the table to think about what they can do to improve health. We see communities like Algoma, Wisconsin, which is another RWJF Culture of Health Prize-winning community, has brought people to the table to think about how do we address employment in our community. So local businesses are working with educators to prepare students for careers that will meet the needs of employers in the community. Understanding the role that employment and education and income play in creating healthier communities has helped to bring people to the table to be part of these conversations in partnership with one another.
We'll leave it there. Thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you so much, Rob. I appreciate the time.
That was Karen Odegaard of County Health Rankings and Roadmaps with us to talk about this year's report on health in communities around Wisconsin. That's from the UW-Madison's Population Health Institute and the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation. Our partners at WisContext took a look at the data and put together a tool that lets you dig deeper into it. You can find that online at wiscontext.org. Coming up, President Trump is pressuring congressional leaders to ratify a new trade deal with Canada and Mexico. We'll find out how the new plan was negotiated and what it might take to get it approved. I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, we'll talk to U.S. Representative Ron Kind about the ongoing trade war with China and discussions about impeachment among his Democratic colleagues. First, we take our weekly look at the top news in national politics. Special Counsel Robert Mueller gave his first public remarks today since undertaking the investigation into Russian campaign interference in the 2016 election. A disaster aid package was held up in Congress by Republican opposition, and the president is pressing House Speaker Nancy Pelosi to support the U.S.-Mexico-Canada trade agreement, a potential replacement for NAFTA. Our question for you this week, what do you want to see out of a new North American trade deal? What's important in your line of work? Is this USMCA something you want your lawmakers to support? Do you worry about the uncertainty that trade disputes and tariffs bring about? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Adrian Morrow is the U.S. correspondent for the Canadian paper The Globe and Mail. Adrian, welcome back to Central Time.
Thanks for having me again.
Well, let's start with Robert Mueller's statement from earlier today. A big question going into this was why Mueller declined to reach a decision on whether the president obstructed justice. Here's a bit of what he had to say this morning about that investigation. Robert Mueller speaking earlier today.
Under long-standing department policy, a president cannot be charged with a federal crime while he is in office. That is unconstitutional. Even if the charge is kept under seal and hidden from public view, that too is prohibited. The special counsel's office is part of the Department of Justice, and by regulation, it was bound by that department policy. Charging the president with a crime was therefore not an option we could consider.
And Mueller also said on obstruction of justice, quoting, if we had had confidence that the president clearly did not commit a crime, we would have said so. So where does that leave us, Adrian?
Well, I think, you know, it's fairly clear what Mueller is saying there, where he's basically trying to, you know, let people draw their own conclusions on, you know, basically saying, you know, on one hand, we didn't feel that we could charge Donald Trump with a crime. So even if we were certain that he had obstructed justice, we wouldn't have laid a charge because, you know, we didn't think that that was constitutional. However, if we had found that felt that Donald Trump was innocent and we'd been able to exculpate him, we would have said so. And we've chosen not to do that. So, you know, the strong implication there is that Mueller does feel like there is evidence of a crime. And it's really up to, because he had another line, I think, in a statement where he sort of alluded to, you know, there's another process sort of outside of the criminal justice system to hold the president accountable. You know, it's clear that he's talking about impeachment or congressional action. So I think what Mueller is very much saying there is, you know, yes, we did find evidence that could point towards obstruction of justice. I didn't feel comfortable making a determination of whether that did, you know, constitute obstruction of justice because, you know, you can't do that with a president. So it's essentially up to Congress to decide. And so I think that's really, you know, sort of maybe the big message from Mueller today is that, you know, I've found the evidence. You know, there's clearly something there, but I'm sort of going to leave it to Congress to make a determination on whether they think that's impeachable or not.
And we've been hearing responses in NPR News from members of Congress. What has been the tone of the reaction from both parties?
Yeah, I mean, you've basically heard from the Republicans repeated the line that the White House has had from the beginning on Mueller, basically saying, you know, Mueller didn't make a determination. He doesn't come out and say that the president obstructed justice. You know, he didn't find any evidence of collusion between, or any proof of collusion between the Trump campaign and the Russians. So, you know, case closed. Let's move on with our lives. You know, that's sort of the message from the Republicans in the White House. What Democrats are essentially saying, and particularly the Democratic presidential contenders, is, you know, Mueller has referred this to Congress, and it's up to Congress to make a decision. And the decision we think Congress should make is to commence impeachment proceedings. So, you know, we sort of got those two. In some ways, the kind of macro line from each party is maybe not surprising. I think what's more interesting in some ways is kind of what's happening within the Democratic Party and the fact that you've got, you know, some members, and particularly the, Kamala Harris and some of the other presidential contenders saying, you know, we should be moving forward with impeachment. But the leadership of the Democratic Party in Congress, and particularly Nancy Pelosi, you know, is sort of the one who will ultimately make the decision on whether they push forward with this, is basically saying, you know, kind of, you know, it is a bit more mooted, you know, and has kind of said in the past, you know, kind of cool your jets, you know, impeachment isn't really the thing we should be focusing on. So I think there's kind of a tension within the Democrats there, where on one hand, you know, some of them will say, you know, it's very clear sort of what Mueller is. You know, Mueller's given us this responsibility. We think there's evidence in the report that points to, you know, to an impeachable offense. But then on the other hand, you know, Pelosi, I think, is playing a kind of tactical game and feels that, you know, voters in general in America don't care that much about impeachment compared to, you know, health care and other sort of pocketbook issues. And she would rather, you know, the Democrats kind of focused on that ahead of 2020 rather than, you know, getting bogged down basically in impeachment proceedings.
I want to bring on a caller on this. Dennis is with us in Manitowoc County. Dennis, hi.
Hi, I was just wondering, if Robert Mueller is called to testify, would Mueller be allowed to reveal anything that's been redacted, or is it just what's been redacted is not going to be available through any source?
Dennis, thanks for the call. Adrian, yeah, there's a fair amount of the Mueller report, even though it's publicly available, that's blacked out. Do we know if that would be any different if you were testifying before Congress?
I think, yeah. So my understanding is I think Mueller could technically reveal at least some of the things that he's blacked out. I think he might actually have the ability to do that. But I think from what he said today, the indication would be quite strongly that he probably wouldn't do that, or that he would try to find kind of a way around it and say, you know, I agree with the, William Barr's assessment or the national security folks' assessment that, you know, these sort of matters are you know, go to sources and methods or go to national security, so I shouldn't say anything on them. Or, you know, or that these are, you know, part of sort of an ongoing criminal investigation. I don't really want to get into that to sort of jeopardize, you know, someone else's investigation. So, I think Mueller maybe technically could reveal at least some of the redacted information in testimony. But I think his, you know, my strong sense today from what he was saying is that he probably wouldn't go any further than what's already been released publicly if he were to testify.
Talking to Adrian Morrow from the Globe and Mail about some of the top stories in national politics. And Adrian, before we move on to what Robert Mueller had to say, he really suggested that, hey, if you bring me before Congress, I'm just going to say stuff that's already in the report. You should just read the report. It's all there. But there's been a question of, hey, maybe he's trying to tell us, go to the words of the report, not the summaries given by anybody else, whether that's Attorney General Barr or members of either party. He thinks what he has to say is already on paper.
Yeah, and I think it's telling that he did choose to highlight certain elements of the report today. You know, basically coming out and saying, you know, I didn't indict Trump because I don't think you can indict a sitting president. If I had found that he hadn't committed a crime, I would have said so. I didn't say so. You know, so I mean, I think there is some, you know, you can sort of draw some inferences from the things he's hinting at. So, you know, it's true that yeah, I mean, he explicitly said he wasn't going to go beyond the report in any future, you know, today or at any sort of future date. But I think it is telling that he chose to highlight certain aspects of the report that, you know, clearly he felt people should be paying attention to.
I want to move on to trade now. Adrian, we've talked to you in the past about negotiations between the U.S., Mexico, and Canada to replace NAFTA with this U.S.-Mexico-Canada agreement. A lot of people may think, wait, isn't this done? We had a deal, but it's not done, right?
Yeah, that's right. So there is a deal between the U.S. and Canada and Mexico, but it still has to be ratified by the legislatures of all three countries. So it has to be ratified by the U.S. Congress, the Mexican Congress, and the Canadian Parliament before it takes effect. So on the Canada and Mexico side, it's actually not really a problem because in both Canada and Mexico, the respective leaders, Justin Trudeau and Lopez Obrador, control, you know, hefty majorities of their respective legislatures, and they can sort of get the deal passed fairly easily. The U.S. is really sort of the issue because the Democrats control the lower house of Congress. And so there's this negotiation going on essentially right now between, you know, the administration and the Democrats to try to get, you know, enough support to pass the deal.
A couple of hurdles here. Now, outside this deal, we had these steel and aluminum tariffs on Canadian and Mexican imports. Those are going away now. What happened?
Yeah, so there was essentially, you know, Trump had put those tariffs on Canada and Mexico, you know, during the NAFTA negotiations. And initially he said that the purpose of the tariffs was to get Canada and Mexico to make a deal, to put a little bit of added pressure. But even after they made a deal on the USMCA, he kept the tariffs on. And so there was this whole sort of, you know, months long, you know, essential back and forth. And basically what Trump wanted was for Canada and Mexico to agree to quotas, to say we won't send any more than a fixed percentage, you know, a fixed amount of steel and aluminum to the U.S. every year. Canada and Mexico said, no, we're not going to agree to quotas. Finally, the U.S. A couple of weeks ago sort of buckled. They basically said, you know, essentially what Canada and Mexico agreed to do instead was they said, we'll help you, you know, because we know that your real concern on steel is steel coming from China. And so we'll help you crack down on the possibility of steel being sent, you know, from China, routed through Canada and Mexico as sort of a backdoor into the U.S. market. We'll help you crack down on that if in exchange you lift the tariffs. And that was sort of ended up being enough for, you know, for the Trump administration, that they sort of dropped their demand for quotas and made a deal. You know, I think though what was really going on there, and the reason why the U.S. agreed to a deal, was that they knew that, you know, and Canada and Mexico had told them, you know, we're not going to ratify USMCA until you lift those tariffs. And so, you know, the U.S. I think at a certain point decided, you know, this is sort of the price we pay. You know, we'll give up on our dream of having quotas on steel and aluminum, you know, basically in exchange for, you know, Canada and Mexico being sort of willing to move forward and do ratification. So that's really sort of the, I guess, the quid pro quo there.
Talking to Adrian Morrow, U.S. correspondent for the Globe and Mail, about the week's news out of Washington. Coming up, will Congress now ratify this new replacement for NAFTA? You can weigh in on that question, 800-642-1234. Do you want Congress to sign off on the new deal? What do you want to see in this agreement? What would you want to change if you could change anything? How are tariffs and trade disputes here on this continent or elsewhere affecting your livelihood? Or do you have a question for our guest about how all this works? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or email ideas@wpr.org. We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our conversation with Adrian Morrow, U.S. correspondent for the Globe and Mail, looking at the week's top political news. Adrian, we were talking about this NAFTA replacement, the U.S.-Mexico-Canada agreement. As you said, the big sticking point now is a ratification by the American Congress. So what are the stumbling blocks there?
So the main thing that the Democrats have basically demanded is that they want tougher labor standards written into the deal, and particularly on the Mexican side, because Mexico has a history of poor labor conditions. Not only is it bad for Mexican workers, but that's sort of the argument that a lot of people in the particularly in the Midwest and another sort of the manufacturing sector in the U.S. have made, is that those sort of poor labor conditions in Mexico allow Mexico to attract jobs basically that might otherwise go to the U.S. Down to Mexico, companies sort of going for people that for workers who will work for less and accept sort of poorer working conditions than Americans or Canadians would. So that's sort of that's the kind of the main demand. And then there's a few other they'd like some more environmental regulations written to NAFTA. The Democrats would. They've also asked for some of the stuff on pharmaceutical patents to kind of be dialed back. Pharmaceutical patent protections to be dialed back in an effort to lower prescription drug prices. And they've asked for sort of a stronger language on enforceability of the deal and sort of the ability of the U.S. again to particularly hold Mexico accountable, if they breach any terms of the deal. So the Democrats have kind of made a lot of those high level demands to the Trump administration, but it's not clear that they've really sort of boiled it down to a handful of specific things or said, okay, here's a specific measure that we want you to sort of write into the implementing legislation on USMCA in order to support it. So I think that's sort of where they're at now. That there's this back and forth between Pelosi and Robert Lighthizer, is the main the U.S. trade representative, to try to sort of negotiate that and figure out, well, what is it that the Trump administration can do that would sort of satisfy the Democrats' demands?
I want to bring in a couple callers on this now. Carol is with us in Stevens Point. Carol, hi.
Hi there.
What do you want to tell us about, Carol?
Well, I just wanted to make a comment that the unknown tariffs from goods made in China seem to be a real issue with my business. I opened a business about 5 years ago importing women's fashion accessories from Spain, and some are made in China. The vegan line is made in China. I sell wholesale only, and the issue is we've already started selling. We sell 6 months ahead of time. We've already started selling our goods for winter, and we have some more orders coming in, obviously, from shows in June and August, but I have no idea whether I'm even going to make a profit this year because the prices are already set, the purchase orders are in. We have to sell them for what we promised to sell them for, and the customs and tariffs could go up to the point where it puts us out of business.
Carol, thanks for that call. Adrian, stand by for a moment. I want to bring on Richard now in Rice Lake. Richard, hi.
Hello.
Hi, what's your story, Richard?
Well, I've been working in the auto parts industry for about 3 years now, and especially in the past year, obviously, since the tariffs have taken effect, I've noticed an increase in auto parts, brake calipers, rotors, things that require certain steels, certain metals, and paints, more especially because of dyes and chemicals.
And part because of the tariffs, you think, Richard?
Oh, most definitely. This has been discussed with me and higher management.
Thanks a lot for that call, Richard. So there we're hearing, Adrian, two of the big concerns about tariffs: rising costs for businesses and consumers in the U.S., and then, Carol, unpredictability for businesses not knowing what the tariff is going to be in 6 months or whether they're going to make money or not as a result.
Yeah, I mean that's been sort of the difficulty for in Trump's trade war is that he sort of has this notion that that putting tariffs on people either force them to kind of come to the table and negotiate a better deal with the U.S. Or that it will sort of protect the industries that he really likes, and the steel industry is a great example of that. But I think what he often fails to take into account is exactly that. You've got small businesses and in some cases larger businesses, in the auto parts sector, that depend on having access to either these imported goods or imported raw materials. And I think that the steel tariffs are sort of a good example of that, where there's something like 10 times the number of jobs in industries that use steel as part of their production process as there are in the actual steel industry. So yeah, the president's tariffs may be sort of protecting or helping the U.S. steel industry itself, but there are all these other people like Richard who work in these other industries that need steel and aluminum and often will import it across the border from Canada as part of their production process. They basically see higher costs because of the tariffs. So once the sort of there may be some strategy behind it on Trump's part in terms of trying to sort of push people into making other countries into making trade deals by inflicting some temporary economic pain. But the real risk for him is that he ends up inflicting more economic pain on his own country than he does on anybody else.
Carol and Richard, thanks for your calls. We're talking to Adrian Morrow, U.S. correspondent for the Globe and Mail, looking at some of the top stories in national politics. Before we move on from trade, Adrian, back and forth with China going on, too, amidst all of this talk of the USMCA. What are you watching for on that side of the trade story?
Yeah, I mean, you know, China's an interesting case in the sense that, you know, unlike Canada and Mexico, which, you know, it's sort of debatable whether, you know, whether Canada and Mexico really have you know, were sort of bad trade actors. You know, nobody really disputes that China has, you know, has done and is doing a lot of things that are, you know, that are nefarious on the international stage and that are, you know, are sort of would be sort of against the rules of international norms on trade. Most of the debate there, I think, is over Trump's tactic and this notion that, you know, instead of sort of trying to build a coalition of democratic countries or free market economies to challenge China at the WTO or another sort of international fora, he's chosen the sort of you know, unilateral route and really has and at the same time has sort of gone after has fought these trade battles with, you know, American allies like Canada and Mexico and the European Union, and instead sort of gone this, you know, this kind of unilateral route in imposing tariffs on China. And so, you know, I think there's also a real question of to what extent Trump really is using these tariffs to try to pressure China into a good deal, versus how much, you know, Trump himself believes, you know, erroneously that tariffs are good economic policy and likes having these tariffs in place on China because he thinks that it's, you know, it's a good way to, you know, encourage, you know, American manufacturing, or that somehow it's going to bring, you know, bring jobs back from China into the U.S. I think that in some ways is really worrisome, because it's the first one. If he really is just trying to pressure China into a deal, there is a certain rationale for that. But if it's the second, and Trump really just thinks that, you know, tariffs are good economic policy, you know, in and of themselves, I think it's I think that'd be very worrying for American workers, because, you know, the longer these tariffs are on, you know, the more economic pain there is.
More coming up on trade with U.S. Congressman Ron Kind in just a few minutes. Want to turn to a disaster aid package in Congress, $19 billion for places affected by wildfires, flooding, and hurricanes. Looked like it was about to happen, then it didn't happen. What happened?
Yeah, so yeah, they've been trying since last year to pass this this relief package for some southern states and some western states hit by hurricanes and wildfires. And initially, the holdup for months was the fact that that Trump basically wanted border wall funding written into this funding package. The Democrats resisted and kind of fought him on it, and they eventually came to a sort of compromise where they put some funding for the border into the package, but with some rules around, you know, how you could spend it to try to discourage it from being diverted to build the border wall. So Trump is on board, Republican leadership is on board. But these individual, Republican members of the House have been two of them now who have blocked successive attempts to pass this legislation. And part of the reason they said that they've done it is for the border wall issue, that they feel that the Democrats, you know, shouldn't, or that the Republicans shouldn't have compromised on that with the Democrats, and that the Democrats should allow funding in this aid package to be used to build a border wall. But then the other part of it is this this kind of process argument where these two Republican members of the House have basically said that they disagree with, on principle, with spending this much money in a relatively using a sort of a fast track process to kind of get it through, and that they think there should be a lengthier debate, I guess, about the about the money being spent.
Right. This was trying to get unanimous approval while the House is on recess. Is it likely that this is going to pass when everybody gets back and they can have an old fashioned vote on it?
Yeah, I mean, it will. Like, it certainly will pass if there's, over time. It's really just as long as there's sort of an ability for one or two people to hold it up because of the unanimous consent issue, or, you know, when they need unanimous consent, that's when you sort of get people obstructing it. But it will, it will pass if they can get it. Eventually, if they can get it there. At this point, it's just kind of a timing issue in terms of sort of when it gets through, when it gets to President Trump to be signed into law, and how fast the aid money is able to flow.
In our last few moments, President Trump was in Japan. He criticized Democratic presidential candidate and former Vice President Joe Biden. Without getting too much into the details, is this a hint that President Trump views Joe Biden as his most likely opponent?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think Trump also sees, he looks at someone like Joe Biden, and he sees somebody who can kind of win over the sort of voters that I think Trump really keys in on, sort of working class white, former Democratic voters in the Rust Belt, that's sort of who he sees as having helped, kind of been the difference maker in the last election. And I think he looks at Joe Biden and he sees Biden as the most likely person to be able to sort of win those voters back. So I think that's why he's particularly fixated on Biden. And at the same time, Biden's a front runner. I mean, he's clearly sort of had the largest advantage in the polls, since before he even declared for president. And so I think that's why Trump is sort of most worried about him. He does sort of see this guy as a popular person who could defeat him. And so I think that's why, Trump never sort of plays for subtlety. He never sort of holds anything back. And so I think we can take it at face value that the fact he's tweeting about Joe Biden so much tells you that he's worried about him.
Adrian, thanks a lot for joining us again today.
Thanks for having me.
Adrian Morrow is the U.S. correspondent for the Globe and Mail in Canada. No tariffs applied to his appearance, to my knowledge. He was with us for a weekly check-in in the top stories in national politics. Still time for you to share your thoughts on a replacement North American Free Trade Agreement, the U.S.-Mexico-Canada Agreement. Do you think Congress should ratify it? How are you being affected by tariffs and the uncertainty over future fees on international imports in the United States? Let us know. Share your story. You can email us at ideas@WPR.org or tweet us at Central Time WPR. Happy birthday. Happy birthday to who, you want to know? Wisconsin. The state celebrates its 171st birthday today. Doesn't look a day over 143, if you ask me. On this day in 1848, Wisconsin officially became the 30th state in the United States. But it wasn't a sure thing. As reported over at history.com, Wisconsin voters rejected statehood on four separate occasions. Why? In part, they were worried about higher federal taxes. But after a few years, they saw that our neighbors were doing pretty well as states themselves and getting a good return from the feds on their tax dollars. Now, back then, our official population was creeping up toward 300,000. That compares to 5.8 million today. Incidentally, if you want to start a state, you have to have a constitution. And one version drafted in 1846 was rejected as too radical. I'm quoting here from the Wisconsin Historical Society. Their proposal outlawed private banks, allowed immigrants to vote, permitted married women to own property, and left the question of black suffrage up to a popular vote. That one didn't get approved. Most of those measures were dropped from the ultimately successful constitution that made us a state in 1848. This is Central Time here on the Ideas Network.